All right. Good evening, everybody. It is Friday night. It is a new month, and that must mean that it is time once again for another edition of Friday Night Frights. We are your host. I am Joe, here with the co-host with the most, two steps away from being a free man and onto a new chapter of his life. What's up, Christian?
Not much, Joe. One more week and I graduate from college, from seminary, and then from there, God knows, and I'm putting my trust in him. I hate saying that out loud, but that's what I need to be doing right now.
Yep. So we are jumping into a topic of conversation that, you know, it's interesting, right? You know, in doing the research for today's, you know, prepping for today's episode, I learned a lot, and I learned about things that I didn't even realize were things and topics of conversation, but we'll get to all of that. We are talking about quite possibly one of the most famous legends in human history, potentially. We are talking about King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, Excalibur, the whole nine yards. So we're going to play a game throughout today's episode. I want you to keep track, and I want you to sound off down below by the end of today's episode. Which one of the hosts is super into Arthurian legend, and which one of the hosts knows enough to get through the script? Kayfabe, yes, it's all scripted. It is what it is, y'all. I am excited to talk about this because this is one of those things that I feel like has been a part of. You know, I feel like I've always been a part of geek culture, so I've always heard about this sort of thing. So I'm not sure I could pin it down to an exact time when I remember that this is when I learned about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and the whole nine yards and Merlin and all of that. What about you?
For me, it's probably one of two places. The first would probably be The Sword and the Stone, the Disney movie. I watched that super young. Still one of my favorite Disney movies. The other would probably be Gargoyles, and Wiseman is such a nerd when it comes to mythology and philosophy and all that stuff, so, and especially Shakespeare, but he puts King Arthur in there in the later seasons as a character coming back, you know, part of the mythos, him being the king under the mountain returning to Britain in Britain's time of need. So that was one way I learned about him.
Yeah, I feel like I forgot that Arthurian and Shakespearean lore and folklore is so heavily imprinted on Gargoyles, because that was my jam growing up.
Oh yeah,
I never really got into, like, I'm super weird as far as what Disney movies resonated with me and all of that, because there's some of them that I'm of the vintage that, like, they're layups. You've got your Lion Kings and all of that, Aladdin, the whole nine yards. And then there are some that I feel like others that are hovering around, you know, I know I'm a little older than you, but, you know, still hovering in that general bracket, that are like, you know, oh, this Disney movie was super impactful. And for me, I'm just like, meh. That's how I am about Sword in the Stone. I'm like, I know what it is, but I'm not sure as though I've ever actually seen it.
Okay. It's worth a watch.
Now that I'm sitting here thinking about it, wasn't there some movie with, was it Macaulay Culkin that was based around Arthurian legend? Pagemaster.
Yes.
Core memory unlocked. Pagemaster. There we go. So we are, like I said, we're talking about King Arthur and all of that. And I'm not sure I really understood how deep this rabbit hole goes. So we're asking the question, was King Arthur a real person? And we are far from the first people to ask that question. And I'm like, okay, so I'm just full disclosure. I came into today's episode and I'm like, what? Huh? Like, this is like, some of the stuff that we talk about, some of the stuff that you all vote for, is like, okay, you know, I get it. But I'm like, King Arthur, Round Table, Knights, Excalibur, Merlin, magic. Are we really arguing this one? But it turns out that there's actually a lot of back and forth about this. And some of the, for those of you that don't know, the general idea is, was this influenced? Is this a hodgepodge? What are the influences? All of those kinds of questions, rather than like a smoking gun of a direct person and all of that sort of stuff. So I'm prepping for this, I of course turned to the Great Encyclopedia of Information YouTube and look up videos on this and all of that sort of stuff. And I'm doing, I'm going through my training session this morning, and I'm like listening to history videos on Arthurian legend and all of that, and I was very surprised. So I gotta ask, and cats out of the bag, this is gonna be a fun back and forth where I say something and then immediately turn to Christian to be like, hey, did I get that right? Did I just say some out-of-pocket nonsense about something that I barely understand? Talk to me about kind of your understanding of this question and your experience with this particular rabbit hole.
Okay. So before we go any further, a lot of this is based off of records that happen hundreds of years after they're reported to have happened. So, fair warning, the chances of that actually being true become less likely the further you are removed from the events thereof. That does not mean it's impossible, but it's something to keep in the back of your head. I think, if I remember correctly, the first record we have was like the 8th or 9th century that mentions Arthur, but it's also a work that tries and does what a lot of European countries did, of bringing in Brutus, I think the grandson of Aeneas, as a settler of Great Britain so that they could tie themselves to Greek mythology, which was a huge thing to do back in the day, just like Rome did with Aeneas himself to the Greeks. So not unprecedented there. So it's a history based on stuff we know for sure isn't real, outside of certain parts that may be real. And then as time developed along the way, other people took it up. But there was enough references for people to go, well, is it all myth? Because this part's true. We can verify this part. You know, this king existed. You know, this history is true because we have a record here that we found. But what about Arthur? Because he shows up fairly early in the story of some of these, historical documents, or supposedly historical documents, some would argue. So what do we do? How do we wrestle with that? As historians, the idea is you want the truth. You don't want to talk about fact in the midst of legend. You want the absolute. So here we are today. Arthur mentioned several times by people who otherwise tell good history for the most part. There's always embellishments. I mean, thank God Herodotus wasn't responsible for any of this. Father of history, father of lies. Both can be true at the same time. So yeah, That's what we're dealing with today.
Yeah. So I found something similar as far as the first, the earliest references dating back to, I have here the 9th century, in texts like Historia Britonium. Written by Ninius. He talks about a leader of the Britons who fought against invading Saxons. Legend has it that Arthur led a battle at a place called Mount Badon, and but doesn't provide a clear-cut historical timeline or some of the details that we would otherwise be looking for or would come to expect as we look at like biography, history, all of that in today's landscape. And that's I think from what I gather from all of this, I think that's some of the back and forth that we have at a pretty consistent basis when we talk about Arthur and Arthurian legend, that there are a lot of key players that are involved. There are a lot of key figures that are mythologized in some way, shape, or form. And there's like little nuggets along the way that are like just enough to be like, hey, this is sitting couched in the midst of otherwise credible historical information from the sources. So the question then becomes, you know, maybe there wasn't, you know, Arthur Pendragon and the, you know, the knights and the whole nine, but what if there was this figure? And what if, you know, there are different, you know, aspects and categories taken from other people and kind of brought together and influenced into what we know as King Arthur. And especially when you have something like knights, right? Like you have this idea of chivalry, which is an entire code unto itself. For those of you that don't know, before you run around calling yourself chivalrous and all of those kinds of things, understand what chivalry actually means in the fullest extent. That's today's little PSA on philosophy. But you have these stories that are like the stuff of legend that's perfect fodder for kids. It's perfect fodder for children's stories. It's perfect fodder for adaptation and readaptation and implementation into other works and all of these other things, that it becomes harder and harder the further and further that you get separated from the time that you're actually talking about to say, okay, how much of this is myth and how much of this is fact or history?
Yeah. The King Arthur legend or possible history is a victim, but also kind of a supporter of public domain, in that as time has gone on, we don't have the original writers around, the original historians around to tell us what was going on. So people can make up whatever they want. That's why, you know, some people say it's a Welsh in origin. Others will say it's British. And then the French come in and they, you know, bring in their own little fan fiction there. Adding on to everything like Lancelot and so on and so forth. So it's understanding that what you are familiar with Arthur is most definitely not, if he existed, the actual man. That was probably never a Camelot. That was probably never a Knights at a Round Table. Nothing the French added in had anything to do with them, but it sounds cool, so they added it. You know, we still benefit from those stories today. And you're wondering, what did the French have to do with this? Well, there was a time when Britain owned various parts of France, and eventually the French took it over after the Hundred Years' War. But until that point, sometimes the British kings were primarily living in France. So their mythology influenced French mythology, who would then influence British mythology. It just kind of cycled back and forth. So that's why I'm adding them in here. And what is probably also an originally Welsh mythology, outside of perhaps the actual history that may be involved here.
Yeah. So speaking of French influence, I have here that it is around the 15th century when the legend, like the pretty well fortified myth of King Arthur and all of the accessory pieces, we'll say, really takes hold with Sir Thomas Malory's Les Mortes d'Arthur, mm-hmm. hits and that's where the Arthurian mythos really takes off, and we get characters like Guinevere, Lancelot, and the quest for the Holy Grail. The narrative shifts go from just a warrior to a symbol of chivalry and heroism and really noble governance that is really some of the big notes that, from what I'm understanding, would start to be what influences where the intersection starts to take place on down the line of what it means in the real world to bring out some of these figure pieces and all of that to say, you know, how can we utilize this legend or this figure to gain power ourselves in a very real way?
Yes. Yeah, Arthur has definitely been used as a symbol of, well, I'm descended from him. You know, I can prove it through this genealogy or whatever. And then therefore I should be king, or you should be listening to me. So there's a lot of propaganda that goes alongside a story like his, that if this is an actual historical character, would not be his fault.
Right. And so for those of you that don't know, because truth be told, I had absolutely zero idea that this was even a thing. There was a shift that took place, like we said, where Arthur goes from being, you know, a story of a warrior and being more of a standalone character to being a part of a larger mythos with all of the trimmings, and this legend grew. But it wasn't just for entertainment. Kings and queens in medieval Europe often portrayed themselves as descendants of Arthur or tied their lineage to his, because associating with Arthur's nobility gave rulers a divine right to rule. Basically, I'm royalty because Arthur and that bloodline, sort of thing.
Yes. Because if you look into the actual mythos themselves, you have, of course, the Sword in the Stone, which is a separate sword from Excalibur, which would actually be Clarent, would be the name of that sword, depending on your mythology. So a lot of this is contextualized in that fact. So they contradict one another. It's not like the inerrancy of scripture, which I'm going to argue for all day long. The Arthurian legend is far different than that. You have very different writers, not under the direction of a singular, you know, monotheistic god, bringing them into order. So you also have Excalibur as well being gifted by the Lady of the Lake, once again, depending on your mythology. So the way those were interpreted back in the day was that was God-given Arthur's right to be king of the Britons. So that's why he received this power and honor and authority. That's why Merlin could be portrayed as a magician and not be burned at the stake, because he was working alongside God. So it was like good magic in other ways, depending on whether the culture at the time cared about that or not. It's all over the place. Some of them don't care, some of them do, but they really all tie into that God directly said, Arthur, you're going to be king of the Britons. Therefore, anyone who is descended from him can claim that same birthright, much in the same way that they would look at anyone from the line of King David.
So today I learned why C.S. Lewis randomly throws Merlin into the end of the Ransom trilogy, because I had no idea. Yeah, that book is terrible. I said what I said. Producer Josh,
I'm with you.
That series is horrible. I mean, the first one's fine. The other two are... Say what?
You're not down on Paralandra?
It's boring. It goes on for pages. It's insufferable. The chase scene happens for like half the book. It's so bad. And like, what? We defeat the devil by getting into a fist fight? Like, what in the wide world of sports? You have lost the rabbit on the entire idea that you're trying to get across here.
You don't argue with evil, you destroy evil.
Oh, a lot of people said that over the years, and a lot of people died because a lot of people said that over the years. Anyway, and moving on.
He's talking about the Nazis.
There's a lot of people did that in the name of God too. So we I'm not sure I necessarily understood the level of interconnectedness that is between like divine appointment. And well, the idea of divine appointment and this idea of Arthur and the lineage of Arthur almost acting as a parallel to King David, like you had illustrated. I also don't think I understood or realized that the sword in the stone isn't Excalibur. Just saying,
That's common.
if you haven't figured out which one of the hosts didn't really know much before today, I think you figured it out by now. But yeah, I think I always threw those two together.
Yeah, it's not even the only weapon that Arthur ever used. He's also got a lance, so it's a Rogmanod or whatever. That's also Carn Winnan, the shadow dagger he can hold. There's this, the scabbard that he holds on his person. As long as he have it, he can get injured, but he can't die. That's why later on, when that's taken from him, he can actually die on the final battle with Mordred. It's a lot of fun with very contradictory stories. Kind of like if as well, like I love Greek mythology. There is no established canon that there is, but there isn't. Like you just kind of have to roll with the punches and just kind of accept what your canon is.
Yeah, so I and this is where I think some of the I'm gonna take the grenade that you lobbed, and I'm not really gonna mess with it. I'm just gonna kick it back over to your side real quick, and say that I think this is where you run into sketchy territory. I'm not going to call it false because, but I'm going to say it's super sketchy territory to start talking about the infallibility of scripture and God's word and all of that sort of stuff. Because if you just leave that out there and say scripture is infallible, God's word is infallible, and you don't do anything else with it, you do not contextualize it, you
Oh,
do not
yeah.
talk about different translations, you don't talk about copies of copies of copies, you don't have any other like work with it or whittling it down to something that isn't just like a block of wood sitting there, then that same block of wood can be used by somebody else to craft something else out of it that isn't what it was originally intended to do. And so I think when you start to get into stuff like this, there's a lot of flavors of, oh, that's interesting. When we start to look at the interplay between "Thus saith the Lord" and some piece of history, where there's some kind of, very loose and very shoddy connection with the word of God or God's appointment to something and all of that. And you see that used in the hand of man and say, oh, this came from God. And thus, this is by default factual or correct or all of those kinds of things.
Yeah. Oh, that's why we test the spirits, and that's why I'm jumping on that grenade for the sake of everyone else. I'm willing to die for that.
So something to chew on. From what I understand, there is trace elements of Arthur's legend in Tolkien's work as well, not just Lewis's, and that they were some of the folks that are credited as some of the bridge point for some of the more modern retellings and adaptations that we have in literature and video games, though it would seem like this is not something that has stayed necessarily en vogue because of some of its association and some of the things that it has that have kind of been that have hovered in the same sphere.
Yeah, Tolkien himself, the image you see if you're watching on YouTube is The Fall of Arthur. It's a poem he was in the midst of writing that he never finished. That later, like everything else that he ever did, his good old Christopher Tolkien came in and gave it to the rest of the world. And your mileage may vary on how that works. I prefer it because I'd rather have it than not. Some people are the, no, he should have burned it in a fire. I'm not that when it comes to literature. But Tolkien was very concerned with the state of British mythology. And that's one of the reasons why he would create The Lord of the Rings, is to like make a more modern take on some ideas that he would find. That's why he did the translation of Beowulf that he did. And that's also why he was really concerned about the legend of King Arthur. I don't know how much he thought about what the French had to do. I would say probably not favoriting what they did, but kind of accepting it as people just understand that it's part of the mythos now. So his goal was to make it more well-known. Instead of like the generalized stories, he would encourage more people to look into it. Lewis, if I remember correctly, I don't know about as much as him and Arthur, outside of, like we mentioned, Merlin does kind of show up, if you don't understand, really kind of out of nowhere in that hideous strength. It makes sense in the context of what's going on with like Britain needing help and like trying of the idea of being under attack from non-religious forces. You needed someone who was kind of a messenger of God in an extent. It still doesn't work, mind you, but you understand his intent if you actually explore it.
I guess if you squint and cock your head, but like you said, it doesn't make it good. I'm too busy being distracted by technology bad, advancement bad, God is the only good thing and all of that sort of stuff, and like all of the very messy plot threads. So to me, like, I guess I see it where like it's Lewis, and he's very medieval in his perspective and all of that. And so I guess it would make sense that he would include Merlin in his works. I've never read anything from Tolkien. I'm not that big of a Tolkien fan. And so I've never read any of his stuff on Merlin or any of the associated stuff and all of that. I just, my eyes tend to glaze over when I get too far into. I think Tolkien stuff makes for better YouTube videos about the mythology of his universe than the actual content that he writes. Because you know what everybody had for breakfast, you know what everybody's ancestors were, you know what color their socks were, you know what they're thinking 7 weeks ago. Like, it's all very dry. And so, yeah, I don't know. For me, it was definitely closer to absolutely out of nowhere. So, you know, we've covered some of how we got here and the broad strokes of it all. So we asked the question, you know, was Arthur real? Was Arthur a real person? And where does all of this, you know, sit in terms of how we process history? So give us the rundown for somebody that is looking to say, okay, so here's the broad strokes of where the Arthurian legend kind of came from and some of the sources behind it and how it's been used by different governments, different monarchies, things like that. But how do we make heads or tails of trying to sort out, was Arthur a real person?
Okay. So we've got, if I remember correctly, there's four main guys. And I definitely am looking them up right now so I can say names as correctly as possible. I'm going to start with Ambrosius Aurelianus. This was someone who in the 5th century, like before the fall of the Roman Empire and in the midst of the fall of the Roman Empire, was kind of a war general chief of what was left behind. And from what we have of history, seemed to be someone who collected power. And then as the Anglo-Saxons were invading Britain, he kind of fought back against them so that they couldn't completely take over everything. We're not entirely sure. There's not too much to attest to him. In fact, I think the first book you mentioned, Historia Britonum, is the one that kind of mentions him. Then we've got Artuer Mac Idain. Definitely screwed that up. These are my ancestors, and I'm screwing up their names. It's fine. He is someone who later on in the 6th century is someone I think we can attest a little more to, but he would fight wars against the Picts above the northern borders of what would be the Britain of this time and kind of work together. And the Artur is kind of like the basis. Some people think, well, maybe because it's that's where we get Arthur down the road as language evolves over time. I imagine that the Old English is not the Middle English, is not the New English that we speak right now, or common English, whatever they call it in academic circles. Then we've got someone called Lucius Artorius Castus. He is far earlier than the other ones and is actually in around the 2nd century AD. But he was a Roman military commander who was like very loved in Britain. And there were folk tales kind of told about him after the fact. And some people think that as a result, since they didn't know what Rome was anymore, the common people, he kind of became like this British figure over time through the retellings and everyone not understanding the past, you know, with the fall of Rome and only like certain monasteries having access to the actual histories, and you know, when they weren't being sacked by, you know, rebels or barbarian tribes or what have you. And I think the last one, Riothamus, another guy who was active around the fall of Rome, and he actually fought against the Goths. And another separate historian, Jordanes, kind of associates him with being a king of the Britons. So those are our four main ones. I'm sure there's others I'm forgetting about, but that's kind of where we stand.
So what do you make of whether or not one of these figures are the Arthur of legend, or if this is like a hodgepodge of different characteristics and different people?
As far as it pertains to this, I think there was at least one person who inspired the myth later on, whether it's one of these four men or someone else I forgot to mention, who knows? But I also wouldn't be surprised if it's an amalgamation of all of them together, and like people say, oh, this guy over here did this, therefore, but they don't know the difference between him and this guy, so they combine them together. And a victory that he won here became the Battle of Badenfield or whatever. And this is how he drove back the Anglo-Saxons, even though they kind of became part of the Britons at that point in time. So I lean out of these four to Ambrosius. He's the one who has a bit more, if I remember correctly, of actual history backing him up more. And we do know more about, a little bit more about Lucius Artorius Castus, which again, the Artorius being a possible origin of the name Arthur. But it's the timeline difference that really gets me, because that would be about 300 some years before the fall of Rome, since he lived 2nd century AD. But I'm throwing my hat into the Ambrosius, but if you're expecting me to say that there was a Camelot, if you were expecting me to say that there was a Knights of the Round Table or Merlin or what have you, you got the wrong guy. I think there might be an actual person these could be based off of. And as legends go on, as people's mouths carry on, the game of telephone went on, like it just got wrapped up together into this cool story, but actual historical nonsense.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here is a big indication of the difference between how history is treated elsewhere versus how it's treated in America. Mm-hmm. Because history never really started until 1776 for a lot of Americans. And the further back you go, the less you have a log of events in the way that modern history would kind of expect you to log history and events and all of those kinds of things. And so I could see a world where a figure is taken and built up and becomes a symbol and a paragon and all of that, because that's all very human. That's something that a populace of humanity 1000% would do. But also, myth and mythology becomes a thing from storytelling. And that's where we get into sometimes myth and mythology is not fake. There's a reason why I did a whole series of Bible study on the mythos of man. Mythos being the actual word of story or origin rather than like fake, like a false narrative sort of, yes, sort of thing. And really you can look at this as a potential origin of, you know, this person could have existed at a time where history really wasn't being documented. Things were tumultuous. And so you could have had lost records over time or different things like that, that would have, you know, been something that would have indicated this, but didn't stand the test of history or wasn't seen as significant enough to be, you know, do I think that there's any sort of association with a King Arthur and God and all of that? No. From everything that I understand in my, you know, limited understanding, it sounds like a situation where a lot of folks in power knew that they could take this mythological figure, or what had become a mythological figure, and the mythology surrounding it, and the story and the lore surrounding it, and utilize it to secure power and to secure position for them and theirs. One thing you mentioned him, and the one thing that I found especially interesting in my research for this video is the conjecture on whether or not Merlin existed and some of the back and forth as far as Merlin goes, because apparently there are some old, I believe they were philosophy texts or history texts that talk about Merlin, but in like a pseudo abstract kind of way, which leads folks to ask the question, is this a figure that at one point in time, even if he wasn't like, you know, this master of magic or whatever, was still like, you know, an advisor to the king or something along those lines, and then story becomes story.
Yes. Because once again, this is typically originated, most people believe, in Welsh circles. And if you're looking at your map of Britain, that's the western portion. And Welsh and English are two very different languages, two very different people groups. So for Merlin, most people attribute stories of Merdin from Welsh mythology and legend to then be associated with the Arthur from that same kind of region that become the myth of what we have today. You said something else and I forgot I was going to respond to it. So go ahead.
The idea of, you know, even though he wasn't, you know, maybe a master of magic or something along those lines, but maybe an advisor to, yeah, a king sort of thing. And that being the origin of his story.
That could definitely be something. And typically, if you're in that role, you're going to have knowledge and training. You could even be the historian of that, you know, kingdom. So maybe that's how the legend got passed down. And there's a book we don't have. And that's the unfortunate part of history. We've said it before on other shows. And we said it a little bit earlier. Like, the further away you get from something, the harder it is to prove. And the harder it is for stuff to be preserved. And we're talking about a period in British history where British isn't really there quite yet. It's not what you think of when you think of Britain as a country. There are different kingdoms and fiefdoms that are allied with one another. Then they hate each other. Then they come together. And there's continual war between all of them until eventually, along the way, after some Viking invasions, they get organized into a whole nation. And then Norman the Conqueror comes in, you know, from the north of France and starts his whole dynasty in that regard there. And that's not to say that it was ever peaceful from there on out, but you start getting what eventually would become familiar to us as Britain as a nation. So at this point in history, extremely contentious times. When people are raiding your town, they're not thinking, oh, we need to preserve their histories. We need to preserve their scrolls that they wrote down that took, you know, years for them to do. Like, no, just burn it down. We care about the stuff that'll make us money or what have you. So if there was such a record of such a man, we don't have it. We might have the scraps of what people remembered.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not hyperbolic what you're saying as far as destruction by fire. It was very common practice. Because the idea is whoever their enemy is, you are wiping out their existence. You are eliminating them from the world and from history. And so this is a lot of the same reason why in Egyptian mythology and Egyptian lore and history and different things like that, there are big swaths of time that are unaccounted for, and why it matters as much as it does that we have the periods of time that we do, because from those, at least we can start to build some semblance of a timeline out yes. from it. But the reality is we are ultimately, as a humanity, we are young. You know, the earth is however long, however old, however whatever. But
that's another episode.
But our context is its own, like our context is a very new or juvenile context.
Yes.
And so the further out you go, the less, you know, by modern standards, sophisticated the record keeping was and different things like that, because it wasn't preserved in that way. And then on top of it, the conflicts left people in a position where, like, their entire history base was completely destroyed and done away with and all of that. Though I do think it is interesting to note that when you look at the grand scheme, like, one of the things that I always try to reinforce to folks that are trying to piece different pieces of historically cultural significant events or holidays, days, time periods, people groups, whatever the case may be, is it's a puzzle. When you're looking at history, it is a puzzle. You take bits and pieces of different things and say, this is the most reasonable time frame or account of things that we could possibly build out of the available data. And when you get out to the more mystical aspects of all of this is where you can very much, from what I understand, see the French influence on everything, and the more standard version of the phrase myth and that side of it start to take shape. But the purest roots of the concept, we can't shut the door on it. And that's what I think is so interesting about this, is I came into this like, no, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to need to fill more than 5 minutes of air talking about whether or not King Arthur was ever actually a thing, because he wasn't. But like, when you actually look into it, there are some interesting points that you could raise.
Yes. I think it's important too, when we're dealing with this, not only could it be maliciously done to remove these records, it could also be purely accidental or purely an act of God. These things weren't always kept in the best places. There could be fires that just sprang up in a city because your city's made of wood and everything that catches fire is going to burn. Or there could be an earthquake that swallows it up. Or someone could have preserved it somewhere that we haven't found yet because it's in a jar somewhere hidden in a cave that we haven't explored as well as we should. We don't know. But also, we have to consider our sources. You know, going into the Egyptian history alone, you really have to consider, okay, who's saying what? Who's sponsoring them? Then you go into Roman history, too. We have extensive records of a lot. We don't have everything as much as I would like, but we have a lot. But you got to remember, okay, Livy's saying this, or whoever's saying this, who was sponsoring them, and who were they having to butter up to? So they're going to say, this emperor sucked, but you're pretty cool. And when he did this, it was okay because we like him. You got to consider these facts as we're moving on. It's not like modern historians are free from this, but there are supposedly higher standards that we attempt to follow.
Yeah, I would say if I had to cast my particular vote one way or the other, was Arthur a real person? It is certainly challenging to say with any measure of resolute certainty, but I would definitely say there's a not zero chance that he was based on, at the very least, a real warrior that over the centuries became the stuff of legend, became more and more of a representation of bravery, of unity, of the ideal leadership that people craved, things like that. Whether he, had any or some of the nuts and bolts, whether or not he had a weapon that then became in folklore and myth Excalibur, or whatever the case may be, whatever the individual puzzle pieces were that led to what we have today, or if literally all of it came out of fantasy and folklore, and it was just a brave soul that was responsible for definitive battles, definitive wins, things like that. And it's way less exciting and a little bit more grounded in actual tangible history. All of that remains to be seen. But I definitely think that I definitely switched my opinion, because I came in thinking that there are tons of videos that circle the internet of historian talks about this, such and such a profession talks about that. It's a nice hearty clickbaity title and a nice hearty concept where you listen to somebody talk about a famous thing and is it true, and all of the same kind of stuff that tends to float around asking these more mysterious and mystical questions and all of that sort of stuff. And I kind of came into it with the idea that, oh, okay, yeah, I'm picking up what this historian's putting down when I'm listening to this historian kind of break down, the very high likelihood is that, and it was all very slanted towards none of this is real. And it was very much a definitive statement and all of that. But we just came off of Easter, right? And every year like clockwork. That's why literally I made that within my media network, we have an entire show dedicated to the concept of, is it pagan? And that was born out of being drawn out and having to comment on, is Easter pagan. I don't know who needs to hear this, but Easter is not pagan. It has nothing to do with anything pagan. Christmas has nothing to do with anything pagan. I promise you, neither one of them. No, and I'll even submit to you, a lot of the popular play type stuff that gets associated with Easter. Oh, I think some of it's been fabricated over the years. Was Jesus born on December 25th? No, Jesus probably was not born on December 25th. Stuff like that. Like there's a lot of pieces that aren't as the classical, you know, Southern plays would have you believe in all of that and all of that sort of stuff. But that doesn't mean you don't get to squint and cock your head and take bits and pieces because you heard it on Instagram or TikTok and all of that sort of stuff. History is more complex than that. And when I heard this woman like really laying down the hammer and saying like definitively no, 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 no. But when she started going away from no, 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 the myth is false, but to no, 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 there's no way that this was influenced by history. I'm like, that's not how history works. There are tons of cases from throughout history. Like again, I'll go back to Halloween, right? Halloween, is it of the devil? No, it's not of the devil. It's not pagan. We don't need to worry about whether or not our kids are dressing up and all this kind of stuff. And we don't need to worry about, no, I can only have a trunk or treat. What, because your church ground is sacred ground? That's a conversation unto itself. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. We like understanding these things, a whole new world opens up to us if we allow ourselves to actually think in terms of accurate portrayals and understanding of how culture is taken and institutionalized along the way, and the fact that it is absolutely common to take bits and pieces and things like that. So did some person somewhere along the way rule over people for a certain period of time, or when was a prolific warrior for a group of people and became the basis in which, like, you know, people could use this piece of information and start to build religious backstory behind it for power and things like that. Did this piece of information become institutionalized and taken, as Sankara said, and absolutely infallible, when in all actuality, it is far from all of that? Sometimes I just like poking the bear. It's, you know, yeah, that's all human. It's all very, very human. So is he real? Oh, maybe, you know, it's quite possible. I definitely, if you pressed me and said you're not allowed to sit on the fence, Arthur, yes. Merlin, I can't get off the fence. So if I had to say yes or no, then I would be forced to say no, because there's not as much to say yes on as like Arthur is. All of the other associated pieces, from what I understand, that is where we are absolutely firmly in the French influence on the Arthurian legend.
Yeah, I'm there with you. A person actually named Arthur, probably not, but a person that a myth made Arthur, yeah, I can get behind that. I'm going to say yes. Merlin, I'm also going to say no. It's a really cool figure if he's real, but yeah. Once again, depending on your mythology, even if he was just some court historian or an advisor, that's still someone you need to have in your court. Overall, like you said, the mythos itself of what has been introduced as the actual story, no, the mythos of Arthur the person, I'm saying yes to in that regard. And you've also got to figure too, it's like at a certain point it matters in that there's an answer, but it doesn't matter as far as like the way the culture has been overflown with references to that original story, with characters actually pretending to be Arthur in stories. Like, you've got stuff like the Dresden Files, where the sword Amorakius is literally Excalibur. My own fiction writing has been heavily influenced by this. I have King Arthur appear after an entire plague has wiped out 94% of humanity, and it's his King in the Mountain moment. He comes back to give Excalibur to the main character of the series, be like, go on, conquer the world, and prevent this from being destroyed. And as well, the character you're seeing right here is Artoria Pendragon from Fate. Turns out King Arthur was actually a chick. It's okay. You know, we can have this in this context because it works in the story. It's not like changing things from different other forms of media, which is his own conversation. That's for other things. But we can have a story with her, have it be told well, because Nasu, the guy behind all this, is also a huge nerd, in the way that Greg Wiseman is a huge nerd. And if you know the history, you know the mythology, you know the philosophies behind this, you can appreciate things a lot more. So, yeah, Camelot, no. Knights of the Round Table, no. Excalibur, also no. But that's still cool. Saying they're not real doesn't impact whether you should care about the stories that have them in them.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's kind of my closing thought as we wrap this one up. You know, an episode like this, it might not be as spooky or as, you know, as dark and mysterious as some of our other conversations, but legends are steeped in, while legends are steeped in mystery, the stories that they're born out of are steeped in culture. And part of the beauty of understanding a legend is understanding the culture that it came from and allowing imagination to stay alive while still appreciating a different culture and a place where something came from. And so not all of this has to be exactly historically accurate in order for it to just be fun. Not all of this has to be accurate in order for it to just be fun. But also, likewise, even in the fun, even in the fantasy, even in that side of it, you can come to appreciate culture and legacy that comes from a different part of the world than you're used to.
Going back to Gargoyles, the quote there being, all things are true, few are accurate, heavily applies to this scenario. I'm not 100% behind that statement, but I get the spirit of what is being said. Also, in context, that's Arthur talking to Macbeth, so deal with that on your own time.
Yeah. All right, so that's it. That's all. That's a wrap. Before we hang it up for today's episode, do we have an update yet on what the next topic is going to be?
Because okay. I got my scheduling wrong. I did not put a poll yet. So next time will be true crime. Also going to be different than the past times we've done it. Joe and I have talked off screen about certain things. It's like, we're going to not it's not that we're never going to do serial killers. Joe would prefer not to. So that's its own thing. We're going to be focusing on more on the Dan Cooper side of DB Cooper side of things, stuff like the monster with 21 faces, unexplained disappearances and stuff like that. So we can focus more on other matters that didn't involve, you know, more graphic things and killers' names being brought into the forefront. I'm sure, is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's about the size of it. When we look at true crime, I think there's a fine line between between glorifying people who are just fundamentally sick and being willing to explore unexplained aspects of criminal history and being able to maybe put some lyrics to that. For those of you that don't know, that's where I cut my teeth. As far as my first gig in podcasting was working with the Innocence Project and all of that. And so that side of it is very, it's very real to me. And so when Christian says, I didn't want to talk about like the serial killers of it all and all of that kind of stuff, because I don't necessarily want to be involved in making the 87th documentary mythologizing John Wayne Gacy and talking about that, or talking about in any kind of positive light, Charles Manson or any of that sort of stuff. If we're going to explore these things, I'd like to explore these things from a standpoint of jumping into some things that maybe you didn't hear about. Maybe you are, you know, more on the unexplained side of things than just talking about some killer from throughout history that likely has already been covered in some docuseries or podcast or something along those lines.
Yeah. So that means we can do stuff like the Hinterkaifeck murders in Germany, or we can do like the New Orleans like axe murders, and that there's no subject that we can definitively say that's who was behind it. That way we get their name out there more. It's like, you know, your Ted Bundy's, Gacy, so on and so forth. So it's not like we'll never do serial killers or something like that. It's just fitting to a new agenda for this. So I agreed to do this. Joe didn't push this on me or force it on me. We talked it out. We decided we wanted to do it that way. So I will be putting that poll out later on Facebook, Priest of the Geeks. Everyone, you can vote for it, more than one topic. Feel free to do so. So there we go.
All right. Awesome. Sounds good, y'all. We will be back next month with our next installment. For those of you that are interested in the podcast feed, this does go up in audio format as well, just so you peace.